he's working with Commonwealth authorities to try and get some social media accounts shut down after they played a role in inciting the unrest and violence that followed the Sydney church attack two nights ago. You'll know that the bishop and a priest of the Assyrian church in Wakeley received lacerations, and the 16-year-old boy accused of carrying out the alleged stabbing remains in hospital under police guard with charges yet to be laid. Police are now on high alert for any reprisal attacks, and both political and faith leaders are continuing to call for calm and unity. But practically speaking, how do we facilitate unity? I'm joined now by Lydia Khalil, who is a terrorism expert and research fellow at the Lowy Institute. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, good to be with you.
You too. I've heard experts saying this morning that to achieve unity, we have to openly acknowledge what the particular potential grievances that the communities in the middle of all this might have. So can we start with getting a better understanding of the Assyrian community in Sydney? How's it defined? What's its history? What hardship has it faced, Lydia, historically and even more recently?
Sure. Well, I think that's really important context to put out there in terms of helping people understand some of the scenes that they saw on camera of, groups of people who are quite angry, who were attacking police and paramedics. I think that was quite confronting for the broader community. So it would help to understand why that solicited such a strong reaction. So the Assyrian community is a minority Christian community out of the Middle East. It's a community that's faced a considerable amount of both historic and more recent persecution. It's been the subject of marginalization, attack, even accusations of genocide by the Islamic State. Because what people might remember is that when the Islamic State was trying to establish territory in Syria and Iraq, it was that territory where many Assyrian communities were based. So the Assyrian community is based in that area in Mesopotamia, historic Mesopotamia, which now crosses over into Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and other parts of northwest Iran. So that area, particularly in Iraq and Syria, was heavily targeted by the Islamic State. People might remember many of the horrific attacks that the Christian community suffered, and as a result, it forced the fleeing from that, their historic communities into new communities like Australia, the United States, and Europe. So even though they're a small minority community within the Middle East, they disproportionately suffered under that. And so when you had an attack happen here in a country where they sought refuge by alleged Islamist actors, motivating that, you can understand the trauma that brought up in that community and hence the strong reaction.
Yeah, I know we heard from a woman who's part of that community earlier today saying that I was persecuted in my homeland and I thought I'd be safe here in Australia and now I don't necessarily feel safe. That's a really pretty recent history of the Assyrian community here in Australia. But also, should we talk about what was going on around COVID as well? Does that give us some insight into perhaps the reaction to police turning up on Monday night?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the face of it, they might not seem connected at all, but there's also that other context that we have to bring into it to bear. So listeners might remember as well, during the COVID pandemic, there obviously the entire Australian community was living under very heavy restrictions. But there was a lot of discussion in the sense that particular communities were more heavily policed than others, which brought up a lot of grievances against government and against policing during the pandemic. So pockets of Sydney, there was a lot of discussion at the time, a lot of protest activity, because many people believed that particular communities were more heavily targeted by policing in terms of issuing of fines, in terms of a law enforcement presence. And so that brought up grievances as well, too. And that may have had something to do with the reaction of the community at the time. There's another dynamic at play as well, too, because the pandemic also brought up a lot of misinformation, disinformation, belief in conspiracy theories at the time. The bishop that was targeted in the attack was an individual who, by all accounts, was a man of deep faith and contributed a great deal to the community, but also was part of kind of that discussion around COVID being a conspiracy. He had a large social media following where he put forward a lot of those narratives himself. And so many of his followers and people who paid attention to him were exposed to those type of narratives through what he was posting on social media. So it was this very complicated brew that solicited, I think, a lot of these very forceful reactions out of the community, and they help us understand a bit better why those reactions were coming out. The players that I think were taking advantage of some of that, there was a lot of individuals in the crowd who were part of what you would call the alternative media or far-right media who were videotaping the crowd's reactions. That now has ended up on social media. It's been picked up by a lot of far-right actors who are trying to frame this conflict in a way that fits their narrative. So quite a complicated picture.
Yeah, sure is. But with that context now in mind, and with your expertise in terrorism, how do you think we can go forward? All these calls for unity and calm, but what do we physically and tangibly need to do to help create that unity?
Well, obviously leadership matters. The communication of our political and elected leaders matters a great deal. So too does the communication and the actions of community leaders as well. And so at a first instance, I think it was quite useful the way that a lot of leaders, our elected leaders, came out calling for unity. I think that's an important first message. So then how can we translate that on the ground? Like I said, I think community leaders have a large role to play. Government may have a role in terms of bringing them together, because I think that there's been a little bit of a dissolution among interreligious and community relations over the past couple of years. Again, you know, since COVID, where gatherings were more restricted, initiatives to bring people together were slightly more restricted. And there's obviously a lot of dynamics going on in the region where many of these communities come from, which has impacted our ability to bring communities together. The leadership messages, I think, are quite important and will continue to be. But two, really understanding the context of some of these reactions, so then we can tailor our interventions accordingly, because it always stems from a place of understanding first.
Gee, this has been a really insightful conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Lydia. I could chat all day, but we are up against the clock. So thank you so much for your time.
Most welcome. Thank you.
Fantastic. That was Lydia Khalil, who is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute as well as at Deakin University. Now, I mentioned earlier, it's a really big day today for Australia's High Court. It's hearing a case which could have significant consequences for the nation's immigration detention system. Lawyers for an Iranian man refusing to cooperate with efforts to deport him are arguing that he must be released from detention, and they're hoping to piggyback off another High Court ruling from last year, which upended more than 20 years of immigration detention policy and, of course, led to 150 people being released into the community. Here's our political reporter, Matthew Doran.
As the chill of a Canberra autumn descends over the nation's capital, another immigration detention battle is about to heat up in the High Court. A case brought by a 37-year-old bisexual man from Iran, known by the pseudonym ASF-17, who arrived in Australia by boat over a decade ago. Anne Toomey is Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney Law School.
The question in this particular case is, well, what if the person themselves is preventing their own removal during that foreseeable future? So they hold the key to their own prison.
Since 2018, officials have been trying to deport ASF-17 back to Iran, but he's refusing to cooperate, insisting he'll be persecuted there on the basis of his sexuality. His lawyers insist Iran wouldn't accept him anyway, given the country's practice of refusing to accept involuntary returnees, and that the Commonwealth can't keep him in detention on the unlikely prospect he'll change his mind and work with authorities in future. Professor Toomey says ASF-17 is hoping to build on the High Court's landmark ruling last year, which found indefinite detention was unlawful if there was no reasonable prospect of deportation.
Can you effectively force your release and your movement back into the Australian community by simply refusing to cooperate, thereby stymieing the ability of the government to deport you, and then still satisfying that test by saying, well, there's no reasonable prospect of you being deported? deported and therefore you should be released.
Any ruling by the High Court will have significant implications. On Monday, the Home Affairs Department was being grilled by the Senate on proposed legislation from the government to make it easier to deport people, laws fuelled by the concerns over the ASF 17 case. Officials revealed there were between